In this whole six series, I have tried very hard to eliminate just talk. And I consider this particular study tonight certainly as important, if not the most important, of all six. But I want to call it certainly as important. It's controversial. A lot of people do not agree with what I'm going to say, though most do, if you can find any consensus at all. It's a subject that deals with identifying and raising the little you. Hugh Misseldine at Chicago University, University of Chicago, has done a lot of research in this area. He calls it your inner child of the past. Grace Kirsten and Richard Robertillo call it separation therapy. Some people call it neo-Freudian. Some people call it developmental history. I would make a basic distinction as we get into it between pathogenic disorientation and pathological disorientation. Now, I'm not real sure how the clinical people use those two terms. I'm using them in the Hellenistic or Greek sense of the term, but a pathogenic disease, the word pathos in the Greek means to suffer, and genesis means having inherited that suffering. So if you are nearsighted or farsighted or have bad eyes or bad ears or green hair or whatever it is that causes you to suffer from genetics, that's pathogenic. But I'm referring to a subject tonight that is basically pathological, which comes from the same word plus another Greek word, logos. The word pathos means to suffer, and the word logos means to utter, to speak, to communicate. And so pathogenic or pathological, in the philosophical sense of the term, means that which causes me to suffer that's trying to speak. Pathological. Now, I'm using it in the philosophical term because I don't understand fully, and I don't know many people who do, the clinical sense of the term. But what I really want to talk about is that which tries to speak from me, that tells you and ought to tell me where and how I'm suffering. To call it raising the little child, or nurturing or cultivating or bring to maturation the little child, is a good way to look at it. And that's precisely the point I want to follow. And it's one of the leading areas of research right now. The thing that concerns me most about it is that so often clinical people, and I've thought about this carefully and I'm prepared to say it in exactly these terms, so often clinical people I'll start to say those who are far more capable than me, but that kind of leaves an awfully large number. Far more clinical people tend to find a new approach, and they tend to say, this is it. This will solve all your problems. You tend to go to Gestalt types. You tend to go to Rogerian client-centered therapists who now we've got separation therapy. And, of course, the real truth of the matter is, and I find this in the more secure type clinical people, is that it's like driving your car into a garage. The mechanic's there. Rather than standing in the door glaring at you with one tool and saying, this will fix your car, he's ready to use that tool if it will help you, but go to Gestalt or Rogerian or anything else, Freudian or anything else, to help you really get at the heart of the problem. So I'm not lifting this particular premise up as the end-all. I'm just lifting it up as something that I have found to be tremendously workable. And I'm not going to apologize for my simplistics, because when you want to learn how to drive a car and you've got to drive it to save your life, quite often it's more sufficient to say, turn that key and point the thing in the right direction, than it is to give you a four-page, four-volume book on auto mechanics and all that sort of thing. So I want to lift out separation therapy and talk about how essentially basic it is. And I would state that in these terms. In my opinion, I feel a little insecure now without the pulpit, so you'll know what I'm saying is right. But in my opinion, fully 90% of the problems in homes today can be dealt with very effectively in some honest and discernible degree when we are aware of separation therapy. Now, there are some of us who are psychotic, some of us deeply neurotic, some of us have pathogenic problems, genetically inherited things, insanity or something else. But you see, most of the things that destroy our homes today are not that critical. Most of the things that wipe out good homes and bad homes are very much like a head cold. They're not lethal unless you leave them alone. But they can get lethal if you leave them alone, and even when you don't and before they get lethal, they are at least very, very discomforting and a real problem. So separation therapy begins to get at the heart of this. Now, I've put on your sheet for tonight the basic concept from Misseldine's book, Your Inner Child of the Past, and I invite you to look at it as I read it. Whether we like it or not, now that's important, whether we like it or not, we are not just adults living wholly in the present. We are also the children we once were, still living with some, even much, of the home atmosphere, the emotional environment in which we were raised. We think we have outgrown the past, but we have not. Now, I want to say parenthetically, from my work and observation, that is especially true of those people who say, I have. Now, when you get a guy or a gal who says, don't talk to me about my past, don't get Freudian with me, or separation therapy, or historical documentary, or any, I am not that child anymore. They are more than anybody else. Now, I promise tonight to say something that will offend everybody, so just hold on. We're going to get to you as the time goes along. We are exposed to parental attitudes, perhaps all of them well-intended, but not all of them valid and truly applicable to us today. But we were exposed to them for many years. They very much impinged on our lives as children. We develop certain attitudes and reactions in response to them. The child within us has not died. You think about it. The little girl you were when you were four is still in you. Still very much there. The little boy you were at six or at two is still very much a part of your psyche. And in fact, there's not a person here today who, as you go about your job as Mr. Wonderful or Miss whoever you are, and no matter what we've achieved, there are times when we feel like a little kid. There are times when I walk in this church on Sunday morning and I say, what is little Deanie doing in here? You know, these little children are still in us. It's a fact. The little boy or girl you ever were is still there. Nor have the attitudes, the good or the bad, left us. They've got to be worked with. They've got to be brought into a process of maturation. Now, I say again, having read Misseldine's essential premise, that I really believe that most of the problems that afflict and affect our homes today come from these little children. Very seldom do I see anybody who has a pathogenic problem. Very seldom do I see anybody whose problem is much more than a little child that has not been raised. I'm prepared to say that and stand by it. Now, I want to say it another way. In premarital counseling, I've been dealing with it from this perspective. It's sort of come to my observation, and by way of outlining this, I want to talk about the problem, and then I want to talk about some help I have found in dealing with it. Okay, the essential problem and some help in dealing with it. But to put it another way, everybody has two basic personalities. You have a social personality, and you have a domestic personality. And very often, in fact, quite often, if not most often, they're not even close to the same level of maturation, because your social personality is what you have worked to become. You have striven, you have struggled. When you go to the office, when you teach, when you stand in the pulpit or wherever you are, that is your social personality. Your domestic personality is most prevalent when you return to the domestic setting. In other words, when you walk inside your house, we tend most toward the inner child of the past. than any other single time. I want to elaborate that along much more around about 10:30 or 11 o'clock. But just for now, I want to say that there is this difference. This is basically the answer to the problem. Why is it when you marry somebody, you always marry a total stranger? The answer is when Ortho and Ephemae are in this dating situation, they are both a social personality. They're using their minds. Most people, problem with marriage anyways, when we get married, we leave our brains at the altar. We go home on our honeymoon. We never pick it up again until the 7th or 14th year when we're ready to give each other up for Lent. And then we want to think again, and often it's too little, too late. But the problem is, when we're dating, we touch each other with our social personality. By that, our thinking personality. Our effort to facilitate our keenest and wisest insights. We pull out chairs, we open doors, we're kind, we're loving, we're considerate, we're tolerant. We are our social self. And that is the real us in a very real sense. But then when security sets in, I don't have time to develop that. But when security sets in, and that's in marriage. For instance, I have come to see, particularly since moving to Gainesville, where this is a much more prevalent problem than a lot of places, that couples who live together outside of marriage are more poorly prepared for marriage than anybody I've ever met. Why? Because they're playing house, they're practicing marriage, but all with a social personality. There's not enough psychological security to allow these people to become the domestic personality and to begin to grow up. You got to have somebody with their arms around you who loves you in spite of all your ugly warts and thorns before you've got the ability to show the real orientation, the pathological pathos, the speaking agony of your psyche. And it takes marriage to do that. And you can live with somebody for 10 years, but until there's the kind of agreement, and that's not always just signing the dotted line, but until there's that magic moment that releases you in security that also allows you to leave your brain somewhere else, the domestic personality does not really emerge. Remember last week, I quoted Clifford Kirkpatrick, we seek two things in our marriage. We seek two things in marriage. One is to continue the satisfaction of the family life we had as children, and two, at the same time, to make up for the deprivations we thought we suffered. Okay, now let me illustrate this. Several things I'm going to say I've said in church in the last few months, and I know all of you remember everything I said in church, so I'm not apologizing for it. I'm just making sure you know I know, and I'm going to go on with it. But I want to illustrate the inner child as simplistically as I can, with no apology, and then try to talk about, okay, what do you do about it? Because if you've got a good marriage and it gets in trouble, it's 90% going to be over this. If you've got a bad marriage, it's 90%. In my opinion, and I'm hedging here, but I spend as many hours in counseling as anybody I know in this city. And I've done it for years, so I think there is some criteria for saying that with some justification. But the inner child, an illustration I've used before, one of the things that used to bother me most about my own life, and I'll draw a lot of material from here at this point because, you know, the only experiences I've ever had were personal. And so I kind of have to draw from that resource. But I grew up in a home where, well, I spent a lot of my time in the Everglades hunting. I ran around with a bunch of cowards. All cowards hide in groups. And we ran around in this little bunch together. And all these guys smoked and drank. Now, I had no faith. I was probably the most profane person in town. I had a lot of problems. But it's not that I would not. It was that I could not smoke or drink. And I used to think I was real weird about this, and they thought I was real weird about this because they knew there was nothing about my life that was anything beautiful or good, and nobody understood it. And I guess I was 32 or 3 before, through a process of many years of self-psychoanalysis, I finally saw what happened. What happened essentially was this. When I was minus 6 months old, not yet born, for those of you who aren't really up on this sex thing, we're going to deal with that. We're going to deal with that in 2 weeks, so you'll know more about it. But when I was minus 6 months old, my only brother accidentally killed himself. Now, I was born 6 months later. And for the first 2 years of my life, people would come by our farm over in West Florida, and my mother would tell the story. Now, most behavioral psychologists concede, that the basic personality is formed by the time you're five, give or take a year or two, but that's the basic us. There are changes and there are things that cause changes, but the basic personality. And for the first 2 years of my life, here I am, I don't understand what's going on, but I'm being rocked along while people come in and say, what happened to George Laddie, my brother? And my mother would say, George went to spend the night with a friend in the next farm, and we've always forbidden him to smoke. And when he got around behind the barn, a neighbor standing up on the wagon seat driving his team coming along the road, and so George Laddie rolled some silk in a newspaper, and he reached down to strike the match on his gun and hit his trigger instead. And as it fell, it shot him right between the eyes. And I can remember as an 18-year-old kid, I remember hitting a guy right in the mouth one time trying to give me a cigarette. Now, you got to admit, that's kind of different. You know, I laid him out. I just absolutely laid him out. To hand me a can of beer or a cigarette stirred up things within me that I didn't begin to understand. That's the inner child of the past. Now, in that particular situation, it's not that destructive, but it doesn't always have to be. In fact, well, I'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's the inner child of the past. To illustrate it again, I was playing golf some time ago with some of the guys from this church, and I mentioned this, but we were out on the fairway at Ironwood, and I drove a ball into Williston. Easily into Williston. These guys laughed at me. They made fun of me. We were all four of us walking along, just ho-ho-hoing, having a big time, wondering if that ball would ever come down. And all of a sudden, now I'm not usually this astute with my own problems. I'm just like you are. When I get home, I act like an idiot too. I just go and slip into my domestic personality and just leave my brain at my social position, and I go on, you know, just let it come what comes naturally. But out on the golf course, all of a sudden, in all this hilarious kidding, I was swept with nostalgia and grief. Just like that, I was on the verge of tears. So dramatic was it, that I stopped and I said to myself, what triggered some tape, some cassette stored in my memory bank way back in my childhood that would cause that kind of grief? And almost instantaneously, I identified the smell of a gasoline engine. And immediately I knew from the smell of that engine that it was a Jacobson lawnmower. I could tell by the smell of the motor. I couldn't hear it. I didn't smell it. But once I smelled it, the background noise began to make sense, and I identified it as a Jacobson lawnmower. And I left these guys, and I went over to the next green, and there was a yard man mowing the side of the green with a little orange Jacobson lawnmower. And what had happened was very, very simple. In my earliest childhood, we had virtually nothing. My father never bought anything that was a luxury, except for a little Jacobson lawnmower. And I spent my life around that little mower. I knew it by smell, the make of the motor. And my dad had been dead about 7 years. And there on that golf course, that stimuli, turning on those tapes, caused me to miss my dad. Now, you see, the relevant point is this. I either identify the little child of the past, or I punch Earl Ferentz in the nose for making fun of my golf game. And I can't begin to tell you how many times in marriage we take all this tremendous input into our lives and allocate it to a totally improper source. And part of the paradox is talked about paradox a little bit last week, but part of the paradox is that we don't tend to dump that on people except those who love us the most. And a lot of good marriages go bad because they love us so much, we can leave our brain completely out of the marriage and just react. Just react. I know the biggest problem I've had in my own marriage, still illustrating the point. When I was born, finally, I came along as a midlife accident. My mother was 40-something, and I had three older sisters, and I was raised a spoiled, rotten brat. I was not worth killing. Now, you've got to hear this. I was not worth taking outside and wasting a bullet on. Now, my social personality was reasonably adequate. At least my mother thought so, and I was quite impressed. I was getting along all right in the social world. But when I would walk in my home, the domestic personality left my brain at the job. The domestic personality would take over, and I expected the current reigning female image in my home, which is now my mother, my wife, everything else, to cater to my every need. And I never will forget the day she called my attention to it. I almost turned the car over. I can still see the spot in the road between Bradenton, Florida and Avon Park, Florida, where my family lived, when my wife said, "You know, when you walk into your home, you're worse than you are when you walk into our home." And it made me so angry, I had to stop and say, there's got to be some truth there somewhere. Or it's separation therapy. Neo-Freudian. Historical development. Pathogenic. Crying out of me. Pathos. The suffering that is trying to articulate itself, but that is really just taking everybody into its vortex. For you see, when the inner child of the past is allowed to run dominantly, not only in that situation am I trying to get you to punish me, but I'm trying to punish you, mother, for the monster you made. And mother's not even there. Now, I know how simplistic that is, but that's all right. And let me tell you something else about this inner child of the past that has become very, very clear to me. Often it is most lethal and most critical in the best homes. If your mother beats you with a beer bottle, you can handle that as an adult. You look back on dear old mom and you say, dear old mom was crazy as a bed bug. And you can attack her and you can separate that and you can deal with it very, very succinctly. But let me tell you something. When you are loved and from a good home, you've had it. Just a little facetious, but you've had it. Now, while my wife's not here, let me tell you about her biggest problem. She came from a good home. Still is a good home. They loved her. They appreciated her. They affirmed her. But when she would walk in the door with her report card and have three A's and a B, her dad said, "We love you. We care about you. We affirm you. Why didn't you get four A's?" Now, in my home, if I'd come home with four C's, they'd have had a party, invited the whole town in. But not her. And to this very day, in fact, the first 10 or 15 years of our marriage, she'd sit down at the table about once a week. She's a good cook. She cooked a meal and she'd say, "This isn't as good as I'd hoped it would be." It's just three A's and a B. See, I'm the father sitting there. And fathers tend to say to you, "This isn't as good as it. You could do better. Why not four A's?" Now, often that's because the father needs for you to make four A's more than you need it. But that's another whole problem. Now we've come along in these 23 and a half years where she'll say, "Well, this isn't as good as I hoped it was." And neither one of us look. We both look at the plate and she smiles and I smile. And used to, she'd say, "Yeah, I know. You're not my father. And you like what I've cooked." But you see, this is the inner child thing. And the reason it's so difficult when you have loving parents, it's hard to attack them. Why, it's so very, we're so guilt-ridden to go back and say, my mom and dad were run-of-the-mill, normal people who did dumb things. Someone said to me not very long ago, you know, the problem in my life is that I need to stop loving my mother so much that I'm protecting her and realize that though she loved me, she messed me up. That's right. That's separation therapy, as you begin to get into it in your own psyche. And gang, I'm really prepared to repeat this. I would say fully 80% to 90% of the problems in the homes today is the inner child of the past. Now, I'm going to talk about that a lot more than tonight. And that's why this is the second in the series, because I want to establish this, though I don't see it as the only tool that'll fix a car. But you see, we're talking about run-of-the-mill healthy cars. And it can be very, very effective, and it has all sorts of ramifications. I worked with a man in another community one time who had trouble having sex with his wife because he married somebody who was the exact opposite of his mother, so affirmed that in his psyche that she was so different, he had her confused with his mother, and who can have sex with your mother? That's an inner child of the past, just on a much more deeply disorienting level. I talked to a man one time who believed that his wife was very unfaithful to him. Now, the simplistic response is, well, it must be he's being unfaithful to her. That's very often true. But in this case, when he was 2 years old, his mother had an affair and took him on her dates. And so he'd had and she loved him and he loved her. And there was a deep, deep burn. So that when he got married, there was a deep pathological inability to trust the new mother, the new female image. And the whole agony that finally destroyed that home in another state was the fact that he could not separate his wife from his mother. And this is true all over and over and over again. Let me just touch on this because it's so pertinent. Faith is the same way. The single biggest problem I have in trying to communicate faith is people who've confused their inner child. Horatius Bonair said 200 years ago, the basic cause of atheism is a good impression of myself, which usually comes from being abused, and you become counterphobic or opposite reactionary to it. A good impression of myself and a poor impression of God. A young lady came up to me in Plattsmouth, Nebraska one time. Drove me to the airport. She said, I need to find God in my life. Will you tell me? She started crying. Her husband was driving like an idiot. He didn't believe in churches and preachers and all that sort of thing anyway. I won't cut him down, but he was driving 90 miles an hour up the interstate. She's in the back seat crying. I didn't have time to get into anything therapeutically, so I finally just said to her, mostly in desperation, I said, tell me about your father. She said, I don't have time to talk about my father. I want God in my life. Well, you want a happy marriage, too, and it's all related. I said, tell me about your father. And she said, well, my dad died when I was 2. And before I was 3, my mother remarried. My stepdad never liked me. I'm 25 to this day. When I walk in his home in Omaha, he'll walk out of the room. And all of a sudden, she looked at me and she said, am I confusing God with my stepfather? She'd been telling me how much God wouldn't accept her and didn't love her. She said, am I confusing God with my stepfather? And like any well-trained counselor, I said, are you? Some people get paid $60 an hour for that, you know. I said, are you? And she said, am I? And here's where I... It was at this point I really dug deep into my training and I said, are you? And she said, am I? And we got off at the airport. She got out of the car with my attaché case, followed me all the way to my gate. In those days you could. And as I got on the plane, I can still see her standing there under that light saying, am I confusing God with my stepfather? 4 weeks later, I was back in Nebraska. This is when I was in Nashville going everywhere in those days. But She lived in Plattsmouth, Nebraska, and I was in Nebraska City, which is 30 miles south. Tuesday night that I was there speaking, she and her husband walked in the door. She looked radiant, beautiful. As soon as the service was over, I went right up to her and I said, "Hello, Cindy, how's it doing?" She said, "I was confusing God with my stepfather." You see, it was my stepfather who did not love me and would not accept me. Separation therapy. To begin to ask the question, why do you make me so angry? Why is it that I withhold sex from you? Why is it that I treat you the way I do? And it's always because, except for real illness, which is not the average person at all, it's because of the fact that I carry so much within my life that just is not meeting the need because I'm not dealing with it. Misseldine says, the way we treat ourselves in adult life is critical for our mental health, happiness, productivity, and a happy marriage. The way we treat ourselves. It affects everything we feel and everything we achieve or fail to achieve. If we do what comes naturally, see, we're living in a day of pluralism. Someone last week I heard define pluralism as the lowest common denominator of social mediocrity. Do your own thing. Everybody just do. If I do what comes naturally, we may be and often are on a suicidal course because most of us are being heavily directed by the little child of the past. And there is no separation therapy. We tend to treat ourselves in adult life as we were treated when we were growing up. We recreate the old home atmosphere of long ago. Now that begins with the onset of the domestic personality, when we get married. And the irony here, another paradox, is that if you marry somebody you don't feel secure with, and you're not sure they love you, you don't tend to become as domestic as you really are, and you tend to think more. Now, good marriages tend to go bad because I've married somebody who really loves me and I feel secure with, therefore I will stop thinking and just dump on them. And remember, the subject is why good marriages go bad. And good marriages often go bad because if you didn't have a good marriage to start with, you wouldn't be dumping. We have a powerful built-in tendency to do this. It's almost as if a great flywheel inside keeps pulling us back to the old atmosphere. Particularly when we're tired or ill or overloaded with responsibility or under stress or over 40. I added over 40. But listen to this. We tend to return to the old atmosphere, particularly when we're tired and ill and overloaded with responsibility or under stress. Misseldine says, when that happens, we tend to go home. And going home means treating ourselves as we were treated back in childhood. Well, what do you do about it? In Kirsten and Robert Teo's book, The Big You, Little You, which I'm recommending that you purchase because I think it's awfully good, there's a chapter entitled Staying in Control, The Power Struggle, from which I found great help and share it with you, giving them proper whatever you give. You can't assume that the child wants you. You say, hey, you know, that makes some sense for a preacher. That makes some sense. And I see that so much of the good that's within me is my little child, and therefore so much of the bad that's within me could be my little child. That does not mean the child will now allow itself to be led docilely by the hand into a generous, loving treaty with the adult. The adult is the child's mortal enemy. That child never got what it wanted and isn't about to give up right now just because we know that the theory is basically plausible. When this child is feeling neglected and unloved, He is the most vicious animal in all the world. He can be totally irrational and lacking in any understanding. He can pout and have temper tantrums. For instance, I've come a long way with my problem. I had to save my marriage. I had a good marriage, so I was careless. Are you following all these innuendos? I had a good marriage, so I was careless. But one of the problems that I have most recently identified is this. I have learned a lot about separation therapy and to say what stimuli caused that tape to start playing. But the one that I have done almost nothing with to this point is this. Like last week, I talked about the fact that we want 100% affirmation. So we walk in the house to be discovered and have our partner do for us what we had fantasized all day they were going to do, whatever that was. Make love, pour hot chocolate over us, beat us with the chain, just whatever happens to be your thing, you know. But we come in the house, and rather than tell them what we want and how we need their response, we shoot for 100% affirmation and end up with minus 5 rather than shoot for 50% and end up with 60%. This is the heart of my biggest problem. When I'm tired or discouraged or over 40 or whatever it is that I'm struggling with, I come in the house. I have discovered in the last week that I tend to hold out as long as I can until I am finally given everything my four mothers gave me, my mother and my three sisters. Now, I've got to deal with that. Okay, now, you see, he can pout and have temper tantrums. He can feel sorry for himself and moan and groan in misery and despair. He can make the world a terrible place. And so many good marriages, especially good marriages, are suffering from this problem, this pathological, this suffering that's trying to speak but not being interpreted and spoken to, destroys more good marriages than any other single thing. So, number one, I had to get rid of my chalkboard because who can see a chalkboard, you know, it's like looking at a postage stamp in Florida field. So if you want to write it down, let me just say, step one, staying aware. It isn't a matter of becoming aware. This is why I just shared with you, I have just discovered, I have given myself trophies. I can't tell you how impressed I've been with myself and how well I've handled this problem. There are sometimes I just wonder if I'm real. You know, I get all choked up when I think about it. And yet, all of a sudden, I find in my life that here is something that has not improved one inch. Staying aware. Place the adult, what Robertillo calls the big, back in charge of the little. Number one. He must train himself to respond quickly to these feelings, to separate the child and the adult out of oneself, and let the adult find out from the child what the problem is. The individual must train himself to be alert for particular signs, and that can be, well, physiologically, somatically, it can be feeling sleepy, head feel tight, ears may get stopped up or start ringing, or the traits I have most often are not somatic but psychosomatic. We may feel stupid or afraid or jealous or wiped out or unloved. But something, it's the early warning signal that my inner child is getting ready to do something. And you'll notice it doesn't usually happen except in the home, in good marriages where they love you and will let you get away with it up till the time they sign call for a lawyer. And then it's usually too little, too late. For instance, in my own life, I have had to work consciously towards slowing down my speech all my life. People even now tell me that I speak too fast, but you ain't heard nothing compared to the way I used to speak. Now, what caused that? I can tell you exactly. When you've got four women in the house, I'm not kidding you. I'm not being facetious. I learned as a little kid, if I was going to get anything said, I had to say it. And until I was 30 years of age, I could not speak slow enough to be understood. Staying aware. Practice. Fight. Struggle with the thing. Well, the question is raised, why don't we discard this child? You know, why don't we just kill him? Well, the answer to that is that so much that is in us, the source of every person's zest and sparkle and creativity and humor and sexual pleasure and delight and optimism and ability to love, is the inner child. See, the inner child's not all that bad. We see it in this differential. Someone says, you know, he's still like a little boy. Everybody says, yeah, he sure is. And I like that. And then somebody else says about someone else, usually, he's still a little boy. There's a big difference in that. One is the little child in charge of the adult, and the other is the adult in charge of the little child, and taking all those good traits. Well, let me tell you, every boy, I'll take just men for example, every man I've ever seen who is standoffish and doesn't know how to love and says, my family didn't do it and I don't know how to touch. When he was 5 years old, he was the most loving little kid in the world. And he's killed that little child within him. And there are a lot of psychological reasons for that, and some of them I don't understand. I don't have time to develop the others. But you see, the very reason we can't do some of the things we ought to do, we have these models in our lives where our dad had a big mouth and ran everybody down, and we think that's acceptable. Or he didn't love, and so we didn't feel love, so we just hugged everybody that came in the house, and now that we're his age, you see, the domestic personality tends to increase the closer we get to the age where we best discerned our families. That's why in the 7th or the 14th or the 21st year in marriage, we often have more problems than before, because I have been able to control a lot of these little kids. But now as I get closer to as I see myself the way I saw my father or my mother, I tend more accurately to reproduce them. And so a lot of marriages go down the drain because all of a sudden you're married to somebody you didn't bargain for. And again, it's because they left their brain somewhere else and they're just reacting to doing their own thing. For instance, I noticed this about a month or two ago. My father had a hearing problem. And it was the kind of hearing problem that he heard what he wanted to hear and didn't hear what he didn't want to hear. And I tell you the truth, and this sounds very manipulative, perhaps certainly pragmatic, but it's the truth. Now that I'm 45... and close to the age when I perceive my father, I tend more to have a hearing problem when my wife's talking. I really do. It's just blown my mind. Now, again, I'm glad she's not here because she mumbles. And I don't want her to think it's all my fault, and it isn't. I find very few homes where it's everybody, it's just one person's fault. But the closer I get to when I perceive my father setting that model for me, the more I tend to reproduce in the domestic setting that child. And I'm always saying to Sandra, what'd you say? What'd you say it so I can hear it, or don't say it? Now, I say it more religiously than that and sweeter, but that's what's going on. We must cherish and nurture the child so we can enjoy all the child's delightful qualities. There's nothing more beautiful than to see a person so adult that they can be soft and childlike. That's real strength. The guy who says, I don't need any help. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not living in the past. I have no connection with my historicity, which is dumb, is the guy that is most susceptible, particularly as he approaches those ages. Number two, what the child needs from the adult. Now, this is Robert Teo. It's awfully good. Very helpful to me. Secondly, first is to stay aware. Don't become aware and say I'm aware, but stay aware of this inner conflict, these children within. Secondly, deal with the question, what does the child need from the adult? Well, that child needs what every other child needs. Love and affection and understanding. That child needs not catering to, but to be noticed. There's a big difference. Put it in within this setting, to say it quickly. Picture of a little guy who's 5 years of age sitting on, and he's in front of a supermarket sitting on one of those horses where you plug the quarter in and it bounces around. And his mother's standing out there in the university city, and she is saying to him, she wants him to get off the horse and take her hand and follow her in the store. So she calls him and he says, no. I can't tell you how my dad would have answered that, but she said, no. I mean, he said, no. And she says, now, mother understands that you're trying to express your own individuality, but I'd like for you to consider coming with me. No. Now, mother understands that it annoys you when you've got your hopes and dreams and I get in the way. He says, no. And she keeps on with this. And finally, as so often happens in a university town, those men of letters who traverse the same space we do, comes down the sidewalk, one of the leading child psychiatrists in all of America. And she says, oh, doctor, would you help my child? I don't want to warp his personality, and yet I need him to go with me. And she explains the situation. And he walks over and with a loving smile on his face, puts his hand on the little boy's shoulder and whispers in his ear. And the little boy's eyes get big, and he gets down, and he walks over to his mother and holds her hand. And she says, I'm so impressed. I've witnessed a godlike miracle. Will you tell me what you said? He said, I said to him, little boy, if you don't get on off this horse and take your mother's hand, I'm going to knock all your teeth out. Now, the little child needs to be noticed, but not catered to. You see, the question is, what does the child need from the adult? The answer is the same thing every child needs from the adult. To know I'm there and to know that you are so mad at them because you're not dealing with me. That's so critical. I wish I knew how to say that better. But the child is saying, and I won't let you blame anybody but the person you're living with, because if you do, you may make me grow up, and I'm the source of a lot of your whole reason for living. And the older you get and the less I am trained and maturated, the worse it gets. It's saying, please love me and please tell me that I'm not as rotten as I was told I was, or as lonely or as forsaken. So the adult's role then is to give the child everything in the way of loving, nurturing, emotional support, and to help him grow up, to act ourselves into a new way of thinking. I have to do this. I think we all do. What the adult is now embarking upon is a program to raise this child, to dialogue with the child. The many people I talked to reminded the lady that kept a drop cloth under a cuckoo clock. You know, everything is just, they just feel so guilty. And they blame it on how people treat them, and all of it's coming out of those first few years of childhood when something happened with an uncle or an aunt or just someone said something that embarrassed you. We need to talk to it. Let me give you an illustration. I'm not ashamed to tell this. I grew up in a home where my dad used to get up 4 o'clock every morning and drink coffee till it got light enough to see, go milk the cows. Didn't have lights in the barn or anything, so he'd sit out on the back porch and drink coffee. I'd go out there as a little kid and say, Dad, I'd like to have some coffee. He'd say, you can't have coffee till you're a man. I heard that all my life. Can't have coffee till you're a man. And so I associate coffee with manhood. Just like some of these very poor to be loved and yet desperately ignorant, frightened kids who associate cigarettes with adulthood. It's the same pathological orientation. A lot of it comes from the movies and TV and that sort of thing, but it's the same concept. Let me tell you, to this very day, I walk into a restaurant and I say, I like a cup of coffee. And you know what blows my mind almost every time? She said, here it is, Mac. She's not a bit impressed with how old I am and how mature and how adult. And I walk in the door and I say, Martin, don't get your little child mixed up with it. Just order a cup of coffee like some intelligent person would. So I sit there and say, could I have a cup of coffee, please? I'm not handling it as well as I want to, but no kidding. I say, my whole tendency is to say, I'd like a cup of coffee. I've arrived, buddy. I'm a coffee drinker. I put 4 spoons of sugar in it and half cream, but at least I've arrived. Well, the same thing is true with guilt. You know, in childhood today, you were raised, some of you, get over here. Don't you know how to act? You never do anything right, you rotten kid. I'll have a heart attack yet from you, and God's going to punish you. And there's more to it than that. Of course, there's death and divorce. All little children feel guilty about divorce. They think they caused it. But you see, it's so treatable. And one of the great things that we can treat ourselves. And one of the first rules is not to blame them for my problems until I first ask, what is the inner child that most probably is causing this disruption in the home? Number two under three, step two, is in some ways, it's so helpful to find a helpful model. You see, it's a model problem to begin with. We saw how our fathers acted toward our mothers. And though we reject that, we tend to reproduce it once domestic personality set in. For instance, statistically, women whose fathers are alcoholics tend to marry alcoholics. It's not because they like it, it's because they're used to it. And when you get secure, we tend to go back to what we're used to more than that which is creative or better for us. And it can be such a helpful thing to find a model. But you see, the problem with that is, for instance, a guy whose marriage is going bad because of his inner child problems tends to avoid couples his own age because they show him that he's failed, and it's his sense of failure that make him think he has no problems anyway. So he tends to avoid the very models that can help him. The hardest problem I had, again, this inner child thing, I promise to quit talking about this, but I'll say it quickly. Because my father was a sharecropper, there were very little social graces to go around in my home. And to this very day, I'm not comfortable on a one-on-one situation. If you think you've got the leprosy, it's not your problem, it's my problem. And so when I got to Nashville, on the general staff there, there was a guy on the board there, Joe Hale. A lot of you know Joe Hale, spoke here last year. Joe Hale grew up in the home. His father was a government diplomat. This mission, this embassy, all over the world. And so whenever I could get on an assignment with Joe Hale, I'd traipse around Chicago, Los Angeles, wherever we'd be, and I'd watch Joe Hale. And what little I know about that, just how to be cordial to people and not be an embarrassed hick, comes from watching Joe Hale. Now, clearly a lot of people aren't going to welcome you into their bedrooms, you know, or wherever models may be that you may need. But just to notice people who are kind and sensitive and who are so strong that they're able to say, I am weak, is a good model in itself. It helps us with anger and hostility or insecurity or inferiority. These little children that are within us, and this is, it's going to take me just about another 10 minutes, so if you have to slip out, feel free to. But you see, until we deal with these problems, they perpetuate themselves. That verse that says, the sins is visited on the generation of the generation, this is the way I understand it clinically. You very seldom see a domestic problem in a counseling situation that was not just like his mother, or just like his father, and just like his father, and just like his father, and just like his father. And somebody one day has got to stop and say, whoa, I'm going to break the chain. A young girl came in my office a few months ago. She was 15. She was dragging a little boy who was 14. They wanted to get married. They were from Dunellen down here in the woods. She wanted to know if I knew anybody in Dunellen. She's afraid I'd call her parents. Well, I don't know anybody in Dunellen, so I said I didn't. She said, we want to get married. And obviously I couldn't marry them, but I wanted to try to help them, and I just took a wild shot in the dark, which wasn't all that wild, but it turned out great. I said to her, you know, the problem you're having here is that you live in a rotten home. Your mother got married when she was 14. She's been married four times. And her mother's been married four times. That little girl stood up, got red in the face, snatched that little boy off my sofa, and she said, you told me you didn't know anybody in my hometown, much less my family. And I said, I don't. I'm just telling you that you're starting out at age 14 to get out of a bad home. You will break up in about 2 years. You will marry somebody quickly. That'll last about 6 months. It will take four marriages to work this thing out. And I suggest that you go home and grow up and do it right the first time. And I could not believe it. She looked at me, and she looked at him, and she looked back at me. She dragged him to the door. He hadn't said anything yet. She dragged him to the door, and she turned around and looked at me. No, she turned around and looked at him, and she said, you're taking me home. I ain't going to live like that. And they went home. You see, I carry around all these things that unless I know why I feel so insecure and why I have these insatiable appetites that no number of affairs are going to fill, or no amount of booze, or no amount of cocaine, or no amount of ego strokes is going to correct. I'm playing with symptoms and not dealing with the cause and raising havoc in my home. So summationally, what do we do about it? Help your adult to listen to your own mature voice of reason. I talk to very few people who, if they'd trust their insights and quit just doing what comes naturally, would have much of their own answers. Secondly, keep teaching yourself that you are stronger than someone told you, that you have got better sense, that you're not so weak and so insecure that you have tried to overcompensate for it by acting like you were the most secure, stable person in the world. Talk to yourself. Thirdly, adopt a role model where they can be found. There are a lot of them. Fourthly, when faced with a problem, achieve some objectivity by asking yourself, and this has been helpful to me, what would I advise a friend of mine to do if their little child was giving them as much trouble as mine is giving me? It's very helpful. Very helpful. Fifthly, read the good self-help books. There are some that are extraordinary. I've recommended one, two in fact, but one costs $10 and the other one costs $2 and is as good. Sixthly, practice seeing your adult as you would like to be. In other words, the social personality. I want to talk about this more in a subsequent session. But the closer we come to bringing the thinking, cerebral, social personality into the domestic setting, the happier our marriage becomes. We have to practice being the social personality and not just selling out to doing what comes naturally. The final step is the process of dialogue. Learn to talk to that little kid, but be prepared for this. You're not always going to be able to make contact. Just like you can't communicate with everybody all the time, there are times when you cannot get in touch with your little child. In fact, you, as I've just done in the past week, you'll catch them as you change and mature in other areas. But to work at it. And the closer we come, now this again is Kirsten's statement, the closer we come to more often being in touch with the little child and letting him be a sparkle in our lives rather than a shackle, the more mature is our marriage and the more happy and the more beautiful. In the words of one patient, separation is tantamount to being fully mature. It is making the decision to become adult. That's why a lot of us blame everybody else. The more often we are separated, the closer we are to being fully mature. It is the decision to really love yourself and to take proper care of yourself in keeping in touch with the will to succeed. Now, we'd all like to have a marriage that was utopian, where none of this was costly and had to be done. But the fact of the matter is, marriage is like a gold furnace. Until the heat's applied, the real gold doesn't come to the surface. And the beautiful marriages are those who meet these everyday run-of-the-mill problems that everybody has, but works harder toward maturation. And in this sense tonight, I'm calling maturation separation therapy. Now, next week, for the two of you who return, I want to talk about a subject that is nowhere near as parochial and pedantic as it sounds. How to scratch the 20-year itch. For those who've got it, and for those who've got it coming, I want to talk about that. Thank you. Good night. In 3 minutes, we'll have a talk back. For any of you who would like to stay, we'll meet down front on the first pew.